Welcome to Linux Tech 2030 third keynote today on day four. Well, imagine a world where you buy a new house, a nice house on a green hill with an extensive garden, a nice garden pond, and you go inside and want to look out and you see a warning in front of the window. Well, you are not entitled to look out of your house because your license to look out has expired. Or think about you buy a new car and you drive with your car, and at some point in the middle of nowhere at the autobahn, the car tells you, well, your license has expired, you need to upgrade to some different kind of a firmware, whatever. And until that, you cannot drive. Isn't that a completely stupid situation? Unfortunately, we experience something similar like that all the time with smartphones, with computers, with TV sets, and in many other situations as well. And how to get back access to the devices which actually belong to you. This is the subject of today's keynote with Benjamin Makerhill. So please give a big round of applause to Benjamin.
All right. Thank you very much for having me. I'm very excited to be here. This is a great crowd. And I am here to talk to you today about anti-features. If you haven't heard the term anti-features, that's understandable and all right. I actually made it up, not just now, a few years ago. But what I'm going to do is suggest that anti-features are a metaphor and a way of thinking or understanding the damage done by proprietary software and by proprietary technology in general. And on the flip side, I'm going to try to suggest that anti-features can represent an important way of talking about the practical benefits of free software. I'm going to spend a bunch of my time here walking through a bunch of examples of anti-features with the goal of providing a sort of tour of the horrors possible in the worlds of proprietary software for those of us that are lucky to have forgotten, presumably the kinds of people represented in this room, and a description of why anti-features exist. I'm then going to try to show that anti-features are only possible in a world where users are systematically kept unfree. And then, at the risk of sounding a little keynote-y, which I guess is you'll permit me, I want to try to use anti-features as a way of talking about three of what I think are the most important fronts in the broader movement for software freedom. So I want to sort of begin this talk, like I begin a number of talks that I give, in terms of framing it in terms of the free software versus open source debate. Now, for those of you that are lucky enough to have missed it, it very quickly boils down to sort of the image on this slide. On one side, we have Richard Stallman essentially saying that you should say free. And on the other hand, you have, in this case, Tim O'Reilly, but it might as well be Eric Raymond or any number of other people who are saying, no, in fact, just call it open, call it open source. Now, on the Richard Stallman side, on the far side of the slide, we have Richard Stallman and the Free Software Foundation, who have spent the last 20 plus years talking about how users should have the freedom to, that their software should be free in the sense that it should allow them to use it, study and modify it, share it, and collaborate it. And, you know, that the software that users have should be free. And I've always thought that this discussion about free software was a little strange, because I think that it sort of crosses this line where we begin to, when we talk about software freedom, I think that we sort of begin to anthropomorphize software in some sense, as if, like, software should be free. Well, the software, of course, doesn't care if it's free. What's important is that the users of the software should be free, right? And so the way that I think about free software really boils down to questions of autonomy, the four freedoms. The freedom to use, the freedom to modify, the freedom to collaborate are about sort of control over one's device, and precisely the kinds of metaphors that were sort of in this introduction, this idea that you have a house and you can't use it to do certain things. The way that I sometimes like to talk about free software is using the example of a mobile phone, and so it was nice that that was brought up there. So if I want to send a message to, let's say, someone back in Boston or to my parents in Seattle, and I am able to send an SMS to them, I'm going to be limited in terms of the kinds of messages that I can send, right? I'm going to be limited to 160 characters. It may be in a world where I spend a lot of time on Identica or that other one, Twitter, right? Maybe I'm very good at writing concise messages, but I'm going to be limited by the space. Now, of course, if I can call someone up on the phone and they can hear my intonation, I can sing a song, I can send a very different type of message. And of course, if this phone has a camera, so if I can take a picture and send it to someone else, and if their camera has the ability to receive a picture, then they're going to be able to, I'll be able to send a very different type of message about the space that I'm in. The point here is that the affordances of the technology, the qualities of the technology that I'm choosing to communicate, the ones that are built into this phone, are going to constrain and frame very explicitly the nature of the message which can be sent. They're going to determine very explicitly what I can say, who I can say it to, and how I can say it. And in a world where our lives are increasingly mediated by technology like mobile phones or the laptops here, the question of who controls that technology becomes an increasingly important political question. And that's where this idea of autonomy comes in, and that's where these four freedoms at the heart of free software comes in. Because the question of who gets to control in our technology is the question of who gets to control us in some sense, to the extent that our lives are mediated by that technology. I don't know about you, but I mean the technology mediates my hobby, my work, and on many days my social life. So the question of who controls that technology is an enormously important political question. Now, of course, free software's answer is this answer about autonomy. Free software suggests that you should control your technology, or rather, users should be able to control their technology. That's what those four freedoms are about. Now, that's the first side of the debate. The second half of the debate, of course, is these people holding up the sign open source. Now, open source was invented as a term to both explicitly distance the work of the free software movement from those freedoms by emphasizing a set of pragmatic benefits. In the words of the Open Source Initiative, the promise of open source is better quality, higher reliability, more flexibility, lower costs, and an end to predatory vendor lock-in. And the idea very explicitly early on was that if you said freedom to a person, the word freedom to a person in a suit, they would turn around and run the other direction. The president of the Open Source Initiative said that. We should stop talking about freedom, we should stop talking about control, we should stop talking about autonomy, because that's not a good way of selling our idea, right? And so the idea was to create a new term to sort of split the products of free software, that is to say, all of the really great pieces of free software which have been written by the community, from this sort of philosophy which was scary to some people. Now, The reason this is a debate is because, of course, there's back and forth. The normal free software response is that this is bad because we're not talking about freedom. Talking about open is bad because we're not talking about free. And I'm biased here. I'm on the board of the Free Software Foundation. So that's my response, too. I think that freedom really is important and that we should be talking more about it. But that's only part. And I think, in some ways, one of the less interesting parts of my response, Because I also reject what I think is a false dichotomy between these two camps, which says on the one hand we should talk about freedom, and on the other hand we should talk about pragmatic benefits. I believe that practical benefits, pragmatic benefits of free software really do matter for a whole number of reasons. And more relevant to this talk, I believe that freedom imparts inherent benefits that have nothing to do with a development methodology, but which are critical to effective advocacy. First, I think that the basic open source model, as sort of represented here, the one that brings us first quality, the one that brings us quality, reliability, flexibility, etc., I think that it's very often wrong. I think that very often, if you publish your code openly, you don't necessarily see this process where the community comes in and improves it and it ends up with high quality and you profit. I've released a lot of pieces of free software. Some of them, like Ubuntu, has been very successful. Many other ones, like Debian NP, you've probably never heard of. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But I also remember periods of time very early on. I don't know, who here remembers using GNU Linux in 1994? Anyone? A few people? There's a couple of people in the audience, right? I do. It was horrible. It was fun, but it crashed all the time. The hardware support was really difficult. I remember going to the store and buying a CD-ROM drive that was one of the three CD-ROM drives which was supported by the Linux kernel, and I brought it home and it didn't work because it was a new revision of the CD-ROM drive. Early on, before the features have been built, the software isn't inherently better. And a lot of people learned this the hard way in the dot-com boom when there were huge numbers of free software companies which came out, lots of people thinking that they'd be able to make a lot of profit, invested a lot of money in these companies, and many of them didn't really work out, at least not as well as they wanted. VA Linux Systems was the single largest IPO in terms of percentage increase in history. And they're a shadow of what they were now. LinuxCare was another one of these poster children. LinuxCare became a proprietary software company called Levanta and then went out of business. Sort of doing open source in this model is more difficult than putting your code online, slapping a GPL on it, and letting the patches roll in. I mean, I sometimes ask people, what do they think the median number of contributors are to a free software project? Like, average number of developers in a free software project. Any ideas? Two? That's very optimistic. The median number, five? The median number of contributors to a free software project is one, a single developer. If we look at only mature projects, if we look at it on GitHub, if we look at it only at projects which have been downloaded 100 times, if we look at it only at projects which have released 3 times in a 6-month period, we see that the median number of contributors is one. Now, I'm not trying to suggest that this is like, you know, that we should just give up here. I think this is not bad news. What I'm trying to suggest is that the benefits of this model are not inherent in this world, because the benefits of mass collaboration are simply irrelevant when your average free software project is just a single person. But freedom does lead to practical benefits, always. But those types of benefits have nothing to do with the pragmatic issues like low cost and flexibility, and they have everything to do with freedom. And that brings me to anti-features, because anti-features are what I'm going to suggest is one way of talking about these kinds of practical benefits, inherently practical benefits. Because the world of proprietary software is a world of firms controlling users to their own benefits and to users' systematic disadvantage. It's a world where users' rights and desires come after the technology producer's desires for profits or the desires of a third-party friend or strategic partner. The result is that non-free software is full of features that users hate. Features that and designed so that users will hate them. They're actually features that are so bad, they're designed to be so bad that users will pay, if they are lucky enough to be able to pay, to have those features removed. And I call these features anti-features. Now, like a feature, an anti-feature must be built. It's something that requires effort. It is not a bug. It is not a missing feature. It is added functionality, but it's negative functionality in the sense that it makes the technology do something that you, the user, don't want it to do. Which brings us back to free software. Because free software gives users control in a way that I've talked about a few minutes ago over what their technology does. And anti-features are a way of designing software in a way that exploits users. Now, when users have control, they're essentially given a choice in the matter. And when given a choice, most users choose not to be exploited. The result is, quite simply, that anti-features cannot exist in the free world, at least in the long term. And in that sense, defense against anti-features represents an inherent practical advantage, like actually inherent, of free software over competing proprietary technologies. And it stems directly from the freedom, not from the development methodology. And as such, it represents a sort of compromise or middle ground in this debate, I want to suggest. Now, hopefully at least some of you are thinking, come on, features users hate? What are you talking about? How common could these be? And I hope to show you in the rest of this talk that they are everywhere and that they are an inextricable part of proprietary development software practice. So the best way of explaining anti-features I've found, as I've been trying to talk about this over the last few years, has been to try to explain anti-features by showing you sort of what I'm talking about through examples. And I've actually broken these anti-features down into four major types of anti-features based on why they exist. Now, the simplest model of anti-features, and the simplest ones to understand, is understandable to anyone who understands basically how the mafia works, right? Sort of selling protection from yourself, like, this is a very dangerous neighborhood, it would be really bad if something happened to your shop, you should buy some protection. Of course, you're buying protection from the person selling you protection, right? They're basically charging you money to not throw a brick through your window or burn your store down, right? People remember phone books. I'm not sure if it was possible in Germany, but in the U.S. it was very common to be able to pay the phone company to have an unlisted phone number. You could pay them money, and they would not include your phone number in the phone book or in the lists of phone numbers. And it would cost, I don't remember, like maybe $50 or something. And the idea here is simply about offsetting costs, right? Because the phone company, in addition to providing you the phone line, also turns around and sells their list of numbers to advertisers and solicitors and people who are going to try to call and sell you things. Now, the phone company makes, let's say, $25, $30 a year by selling your information to companies who are going to spam you, basically. So the phone company is willing to say, well, you know, we're willing to not do that if you're willing to pay us more than they're willing to pay, right? This is the basic sort of idea. This is the basic model. And this kind of anti-feature you find everywhere. I don't know if people remember Claria or Gator. People remember Gator? It's amazing that not many people know about Gator because Gator was an incredibly popular piece of software that ran on Windows. It was installed on something like 35 million computers. But what was really funny is that almost no one remembered ever installing it. In fact, no one remembered ever installing it. Because Gator, which changed its name to Claria to try to clean up its image, although they didn't change their behavior, was a piece of spyware. It was shipped with Kazaa. It was shipped with DivX, the software that would, so Kazaa, the file sharing system, and DivX, the video decoding system, as sort of an extra piece of software, and it did all kinds of really horrible things. It would monitor all your browsing. It would look for ads that were being shown to you on banner pages and replace them with different ads. It would look for other programs which were trying to intercept its ads and attack those programs. It was like Core Wars in your computer, right? And there were tons of these pieces of things. Gator was one of the biggest ones. But this phenomena, it's a great example of an anti-feature because, in fact, DivX sold two versions. There was the free version, which you would download, which included Gator. And, of course, DivX, the people who were distributing the software, were paid by Gator to install this software on your computer. Or you could buy the premium version of DivX. And the premium version of DivX was exactly the same. It just didn't include Gator. And in fact, the zip file was smaller because it didn't include all the additional pieces of spyware. It actually just had less software, right? So otherwise, it was exactly the same. This is very hard for you guys to read, so I'll read it for you. This is a similar example from Sony. They offered a feature a couple years ago called Fresh Start. When you bought your computer, you could choose between the first option, which is no fresh start, subtract $49, which is kind of like a weird, wait, so I get no fresh start and I subtract money? Or you could pay for fresh start, which was $49.99. And fresh start, the description says, opt for a fresh start, trademark, And your VIO PC will undergo a system optimization service where specific VIO applications, trial software, and games will be removed from your unit prior to shipment. Fresh Start safely scrubs your PC to free up valuable hard disk space and conserve memory and processing power while maximizing overall system performance right from the start. Right? So if you've ever paid the Windows tax, then you know what this is about, right? If you open up a computer, it's completely full of stuff you do not want, right? It's completely full of software which is, you know, if not quite as bad as Gator, you know, games that you don't want, all these sorts of things. And of course, the reason is because the companies who are selling your computers, in this case Sony, are making money from all of these people who are installing all of this crapware and bloatware on your computer. And the problem was is that apparently the system in Sony had become so overloaded by this bloatware that it was seriously like reducing the functionality of the machine. One of the reviews of the Sony VAIO without Fresh Start said that the laptop blue screened the first time that the reviewer turned it on, and it crashed the first time it was shut down because of all the bloatware. Laptop Magazine said that the VAIO in question, quote, behaved as if it was broken before the unwanted software was removed. So Sony was like, great, we'll charge you $50, and then we'll uninstall all the software for you, right? Help you out with the process. Sony eventually relented after getting a ton of negative publicity from this. I mean, I suppose this talk is an example of how, even though they've removed it, the negative publicity continues. But they continue to sell lots of bloatware within their computers. Most manufacturers do. This is the kind of thing that you can do. So that's the first class, right? Very simple. Pay me money. Or else I'm going to do something to you that you don't want. And if you want to use my software, or you happen to be buying a laptop from me, tough luck. Welcome to my world, unless you want to install GNU Linux on it. Now, a related version of this story is around what some people call market segmentation. This is the term they use in business schools. I actually, believe it or not, teach in business schools. I teach at MIT, at the business school. People also call it price discrimination, which it sounds worse. The people who do it don't like to call it that. But the idea here is familiar to anyone who's ever, you know, like bought a ticket on an airplane. I forget who said. Someone once told me that if you'd put the prices that people paid for their airplane ticket, like above each seat, that there would be like riots on airplanes, like people like, you know, tearing each other out, because of course, you know, the person sitting next to you in basically exactly the same seat has paid three times more or half as much as you have, right? Because airlines engage in this very complicated pricing systems, which are designed to get as much money out of everyone as possible, and so they do things like, we want to charge the business travelers more, so if they stay over a weekend, then that means they're probably not a business traveler, so then we can charge them less. And they have all these complicated systems that try to charge many different people many different amounts of money. The idea here is that some people can pay more. And so you want to segment your market so that you can sell the expensive things with the high margins to the people that can pay them and the cheap things to the people that can't. Now, this basic process is just like a goldmine for anti-features. The history of Microsoft Windows can be read as a history of doing this kind of market segmentation, right? This trying to squeeze more money out of people by making their software worse so that they buy the more expensive version. So here's a short version of that history. I like to start my history with Windows NT Workstation 4.0. People remember Windows NT Workstation 4.0? Or the very similar Windows NT Server 4.0. Both were released in 1996. And the server version included a series of server applications that were not bundled with the Workstation edition. But overall, they were very similar operating systems. And despite the similarity, or the apparent similarity, Microsoft maintained that the Workstation and NT Workstation and NT Server were, quote, two very different products intended for two very different functions. The server version, Microsoft claimed, was suited and tailored for use as an internet server, while the Workstation version was grossly inadequate. So in aiming to enforce or reflect this difference, the Workstation code and the license restricted users to no more than 10 concurrent TCP connections. So if you used the Workstation, if you used the server version, you could make as many TCP connections as you wanted, as many network connections as you wanted. But if you used the Workstation version, which cost $800 less, you you could only make 10 concurrent TCP connections, right? Now, a number of people realized that, as I mentioned, that these operating systems were very similar. And in fact, an editor at O'Reilly noticed that, in fact, they were very, very similar. In fact, if you MD5'd all of the files, you found that they were identical. Like, the software was exactly the same. The only difference between NT Workstation and NT Server was a single bit set in the registry upon installation, which would describe to the system whether or not it was a workstation or if it was a server. Now, if it was a workstation, then the software, when it loaded up, would say, aha, I'm a workstation, and it would activate a bunch of code which would limit the number of TCP connections that you could have. Now, of course, when people found out about this, they were very happy because it meant they could make a one-bit change to essentially a configuration file on their computer, and they could have an $800 upgrade to their software. Microsoft was less happy about it. But of course, Microsoft has learned their lesson, I'm sure, right? You can today choose between a huge list of different versions of Windows 8. This is actually an enormous reduction from Windows 7, where they had three times as many versions. One of the biggest differences between Windows 8 and Windows 8 Pro is about how much memory you'd like to be able to use on it. So if you want to buy, because of course they have written an anti-feature. I mean, in the same way that there was an anti-feature back here, they had written an anti-feature which was designed to determine whether you have, how much memory you have in your machine, and if you have too much memory, it just simply will not give you access to it. Not because there's anything about the software that keeps them from doing it, except that they've written a new feature to do this, right? Can you imagine being the person at Microsoft, or the team of people at Microsoft whose job it is to come to work every day and to build the feature which is going to keep people from using more than 10 concurrent connections or more than 100 gigabytes of memory or whatever the particular restriction is, right? These are features which are designed only to make the software bad enough that people will move to the more expensive version. Another clear example of this is around this sort of single language version, right? So Windows 8 releases a version which you cannot switch the language of. So the idea is that they want to sell a very cheap version in places like China or in India, but they don't want it to be able to be used on the English market, right? Or anywhere else. And so they've designed, if you've written code, you know that when you write the strings, you write them first in one language and then sort of change them out. They have gone through the trouble of stripping all the strings out of the code so that you cannot change the language to anything else, right? There is a team of people whose goal it is to make this software not work in other languages, right? There's lots of other examples of this. This is a version of Windows. This is Windows 7 Starter. There was also Windows Vista Starter. They have not yet introduced a Windows 8 Starter. But my favorite there were two anti-features that I absolutely love in this one, right? The first one is that you can't change the background. They have designed it so that you can't change the background image. You're stuck with the default background because they think people what? Like GNOME 3. Maybe. Well, I've changed my GNOME 3 background. The most impressive one is that they've limited the number of maximum programs with a graphical user interface that you can have open. It's three. You can have up to three programs with a graphical user interface open. Think about it. If you're an engineer, like this is not a trivial thing to do. You need to detect whether or not a program is going to launch a graphical user interface. You need to then have an interface for prompting the user to tell them, keeping track of how many are open, prompting users to tell them that they haven't done that. There is a team of people who write this and test this, and I don't know how they go home and sleep every night. This is software designed. The whole purpose of Windows Starter is to make an operating system which they can effectively give away for free that is so bad that anybody with money will pay to get away from it, right? Like this is the goal of Windows Starter, is to make something so full of anti-features that anyone who can will move up to the more expensive version, right? And this kind of behavior is completely standard in the world of proprietary software. This is a G7 camera. It's a sort of Canon camera, and it again exists in this sort of world of market segmentation. Canon releases many different cameras. They release very cheap point and shoot cameras. They release very complicated and expensive digital SLRs with the lenses that you can take on and off them. And this is a camera, the G series camera, exists somewhere between these two. It's the sort of most expensive version of the point and shoot or the cheapest sort of fancier camera. Now, the G1 through G6 had the ability to shoot RAW. People know what RAW is. It's a format for taking pictures that allows you to do certain kinds of like darkroom style effects. But RAW, of course, isn't really a format. RAW is just a description of RAW sensor data. Now, when the G7 came out, it didn't include the ability to shoot RAW because Canon wanted to push people to the higher market segment. They had released a cheaper SLR and they wanted the ability to sell people more lenses. So they took away the ability to shoot RAW, right? But of course, it's, because the RAW, every time you take a picture, a RAW photo exists in your camera, right? Which means that, the basic idea is an anti-feature because it's harder to compress a JPEG than it is to not compress a JPEG. Saving a RAW photo is simply not executing some code on the camera. Now, this is where sort of the more free world comes in, because although this camera is not free software in any way, hackers have been able to build a platform on top of it called CHDK. It's the Canon Hackers Dev Kit. It's very cool. I know there was a talk earlier today that was on similar area topics. But CHDK existed initially as sort of a free software platform for adding RAW back into cameras. And of course, the reason you can add RAW back into the cameras as soon as you open up the ability for hackers to work is they don't have to write any functionality. All they have to do is turn off functionality, right? And this is where the free world comes back in. Because this is the other side of anti-features. Not only are anti-features tempting and irresistible in the world of proprietary software, in this world of Windows Vista Starter, Windows 7 Starter, in a world where freedom is an option, even where it's an option which has to be sort of pulled by force, anti-features are the first thing to fall because they require very little work from us. Sometimes negative work. Now, the third type of anti-features is around securing monopolies. I want to suggest and of course that happens in a variety of different ways. Here's one way in which anti-features can be used to secure monopolies. People remember this, but Panasonic upgraded the firmware on their cameras a few years. They released an upgrade to the firmware on their cameras. And a number of people, when they downloaded the firmware and installed it on their cameras, realized that their cameras didn't start afterwards. And people eventually figured out that all of the people whose cameras refused to start were using third-party batteries. Because Panasonic had, in the firmware upgrade, designed their camera to notice when people had used a third-party battery and to simply refuse to work when that battery is installed. So all these people that had bought their cameras and been using batteries for some time were very upset. Panasonic got a lot of bad press about this. They're continuing to get bad press about it now. And eventually they relented and released a new version of the software which allowed you to use it with your third-party battery. But this is enormously common. And in some ways, Panasonic was just not smart about how they were doing it. This is called accessory control. There's a great book called Security Engineering by professor of computer science at Cambridge University called Ross Anderson, who says in his book, it is common for the makers of game consoles to build in challenge response protocols to prevent software cartridges or other accessories from being used with their product unless a license fee is paid. The practice is spreading. According to one vendor of authentication chips, some printer companies have begun to embed an authentication in printers to ensure that genuine toner cartridges are used. If the competitor's product is loaded instead, the printer will quietly downgrade from 1200 dpi to 300 dpi. In mobile phones, much of the profit is made on batteries, and exactly the example I just showed you. The authentication protocols can be used to spot competitors' products so they can be drained more quickly. Panasonic's mistake was they didn't do what everyone else was doing, which is allowing you to use the third-party battery but just turning off the power-saving features so your batteries drain more quickly and you go back to the name-brand product, right? This is the kind of thing that happens in a world where we don't have control of our technology, where we can't see what's going on in hardware devices and in software. This is a data sheet from the Atmel SA100S crypto authentication integrated controller. This is a chip that, according to its datasheet and according to Atmel, will, quote, provide a solution to prevent counterfeiters from producing batteries that can damage equipment to a manufacturer's device, a manufacturer's reputation, and or reduce their potential revenue stream. Right? The Atmel chip, this battery authentication chip, uses SHA-256 because the SHA-1 that was used before isn't strong enough. It goes in every battery, probably every battery in every phone in this room, and it costs at bulk. If you order thousands of chips, it costs $1 a piece. Every battery, the batteries only cost $10, right? And every battery, you're paying 10% of the cost to a chip, which you have never asked for certain, right? And which is only designed to, if you buy the wrong battery, make your experience worse, right? We're paying for this when we buy devices. We're paying for this when we support proprietary technologies. There's an arms race being fought, and this chip is an example of this. This is why we see them releasing stronger forms of encryption in each new revision, because there's an arms race being fought, and we, the users, are the casualties. We're stuck in the middle. This is an attempt by manufacturers to eliminate users' choice and control over technologies by trying to protect the high margins that we are paying on the batteries themselves. And this only works because users are kept helpless, divided, and entirely dependent. Secured monopoly would make it possible for companies to use loss leaders and subscription-based services, right? This is printer cartridges involve such complicated authentication that they've been the subject of a major copyright case in the U.S. People were arguing that, like, you were violating copyright by copying all of the code which is in the authentication chip in the printer. It ended up being a sort of complicated case, but there's an enormous amount of code that goes into these systems, which are not with the idea being that they can sell you the printer for cheap and then sell you these cartridges, and you won't be able to use the other cartridges, or at least not in a way that allows you to work more, to work as well. No customer has ever demanded being barred from refilling their own printer cartridges or from using one from a third party, being like, you know, the only problem with this printer is that I can really just use any cartridge I want and I can refill it myself. You know, could I get the version of the printer that actually just, like, gives me no options there? That would be really great. I'd love to just pay huge amounts of money every time, right? Game systems work this way. We sell a cheap game system, and then we make up the loss from the cheap game system by selling lots of licensed games, right? The Xbox was a very clear example of this. The original Xbox was basically just a bunch of standard PC components. And Microsoft, of course, who, when they released the first Xbox, realized that this was just a bunch of standard PC components. And so they invested an enormous amount of effort into making sure the Xbox could do less than the hardware could. Right? Namely, they wanted it to do only one thing. They wanted it to play Microsoft licensed games and absolutely nothing else. Right? There was a huge amount of effort and engineering and money, you know, millions and millions of dollars that Microsoft, you know, R&D that went into making sure the Xbox did not do a number of things, but in particular that it did not run GNU Linux. Right? The Xbox was specifically designed, highly engineered, to not run GNU Linux and free software. It was a clear anti-feature. TiVoization, right? This idea that you can take that I can take a piece of hardware, I can use free software in it, but I can use sort of crypto to keep you from changing that free software. So in addition to sort of working around the license and being sort of just like a generally kind of crappy thing to do, it's also not free. We pay for it. You pay for it when you buy a TiVo, right? You're paying for the engineering effort that goes into making it so that you can't change the software on your TiVo, so that you can't load in, data on shows from different places, from different sources, so that you can't have control over what your device does, right? It's in the cost of subscriptions, and we cannot pay to turn it off ourselves. So the fourth and final sort of category of anti-feature, sort of reason for anti-feature to exist, is really a subset of this monopoly protection, but it's a particular type of monopoly that I think warrants singling out. It's the idea of sort of protecting copyrights, and I've put protecting in scare quotes because I think it's scary, and of course because the people, you know, we're protecting the copyrights from the users of the material, right? Copyright protection systems have been demanded by essentially no users and have been forced on nearly everyone. We've all had to deal with copyright protection of some sort or another, and no one's like, you know, the problem with this piece of music is that I really just can't copy it to every place that I would want. Do people recognize this? It's very hard to see. People, SimCity, that's right. So this is hard to see because it's designed to be impossible to photocopy. But it was also like very hard to see in real life. And the idea was is that this is a place where when you open the game, when you bought the game, they would give you this piece of paper, and the paper would be difficult to reproduce because it was hard to photocopy. And then the picture, when you open the game, it would say, what is the population of this city, or what is the matchup with this little images right here? And you would have to go through this physical piece of paper and find the right thing, find the right number so that the game would then start. If you've ever used like a game, like an old game that said like turn to page, you know, N of the manual and what's the fifth word or something like that, this kind of thing. These things cost money to build and effort to build, and you know, no user has ever demanded it. You know, I hate the way the game just loads up right away. I'm not asked to do some really stupid task. Anyone here ever had to use a dongle? A security dongle? A few people, right? Dongles, man. They're like this universally hated thing, right? I actually have a friend who, dongles are, of course, are these physical objects that you're supposed to plug into your computer so that your proprietary software won't start unless you have this physical thing plugged into it. I had a friend who worked did underwater robots, and they had some very expensive software that they used on the boat. And they on two occasions had their dongle like corrode because of the seawater, and they had to go, like, costing enormous amounts of money, had to go back into to harbor to pick up a new dongle. Because the software was working fine, the computer was working fine, everything was working fine except the security system, which no one wanted, right? That it was sort of getting in the way. People are paying to engineer and build these things, often at significant portions of the cost of our technology. Here's the reality, right, around this idea of protecting copyrights. We all have copying machines on our desk. I have one right in front of me. Great general-purpose copying machines, the best copying machines ever built. We can copy things perfectly and send them everywhere, right? And it's depressing to think about this, but one of the greatest engineering problems of the last two decades has been making these perfect copying machines into less good copying machines. Finding ways to make these machines less good at copying things or running the things which have been copied. I could give an entire talk about DVDs. It's hard to even know where to start. I could talk about region coding. No one's like, you know, I just hate the way I can bring my DVDs everywhere. I could talk about encryption, watermarking technologies, all anti-features, none of them with, a lot of people cheering for them. But there's just one thing that I want to remind everyone about. That unskippable track at the beginning of every DVD, right? With the copyright notice, and now like with the ads, which you're forced to watch, and you're like, everyone, how many combined thousands, tens of thousands of years of human life have been spent by people pressing forward on the button and having it not work as the thing went by, right? How much human life has been wasted by people watching crap that they're trying to skip, putting up with frustration and unhappiness brought by their technologies? I have heard rumors of, but have never met, a free software DVD player that honored the unskippable track. Because when you build a free software system, no one wants to put up with it, right? Why would you build that feature in? And in that sense, there's hope, right? So, it's rough. There's hope because, and there's hope in free software. Because the freedom to modify software in any way is, of course, the freedom to remove functionality that one does not want. And the freedom to share software or to collaborate is the freedom to work together, to work around predatory practices like anti-features. Because when we have freedom, anti-features are impossible. Or at the very least, anti-features become low-hanging fruit for free software and for the kinds of people that are in this room. As developers, all we need to do is not build something and that our users don't want and which they're being forced to have. So which version of Ubuntu do I want? How much memory do I want? How many applications do I want to run at a given point in time? If my answers to that question matter, how long do we think it would take Ubuntu before it was forked into someone who basically didn't force users to make that choice, right? And the answer, of course, is no time at all, which is why they wouldn't do it. Free software keeps producers and developers honest in a way that sometimes puts some business practices off limits. But these are business practices which users don't want, and in that sense, they represent an inherent advantage for free software. Now, as I suggested, I want to spend the last few minutes of my talk potentially sounding a little keynote-y by talking about how anti-features give us a way, to understand and to explain what I think three of the most important frontiers are in the struggle for software freedom. My idea here is that anti-features, and what I'm trying to convince you is that anti-features are, in addition of sort of like a funny tour of some of the ways in which people are being taken advantage of, that they're a way for us to think about benefits around free software, and a way for us to talk about some of the damage done by proprietary software in a way that can make for more effective advocacy. Now, the three areas I'm going to talk about here are mobile phones, network services, and DRM. Three, I think, critically important areas for software freedom, all ones that we can use anti-features to talk about. And I'll show you how to do that. Now, mobile phones are both the most widely distributed form of powerful computers and are incredibly unlikely to act like computers because they are almost universally locked down to a degree that should seem extraordinary to all of us here, but which we basically mostly take for granted. The image on this slide is apparently a SIM unlocker, which lets users defeat an anti-feature designed to keep their phones from working with SIM cards that they would like it to work with, because a large number of phones, of course, in the world come locked to a particular carrier. This is basically an enforcing monopoly-style anti-feature. But I don't need to tell you about locked phones, because despite the fact that we all hate it, we understand that these things exist in the world, and we just seem to take it. If this were a more general audience, or maybe even if this particular audience, I'd ask how many of you have root on your phone? How many of you have root on your phone? I do. A few. That's great. Suffice it to say, most people do not. Cryptographic systems that prevent the installation of approved or sort of unsigned images, an expensive anti-feature, included in the prices of most phones sold worldwide. We pay for these lockdown systems. Even the best example of free software-friendly phones, anti-features are clear. A lot of Android-based phones now have tended to come in a couple versions. On the one hand, you have the cheaper version that is locked to a carrier contract or locked with keys that are by the manufacturer, even by the phone company, so that you essentially can't change the software that runs on it, or you can get the unlocked version, the developer phone. In the US, the developer phones cost, on average, about $250 more. That's the freedom tax. And when I get a phone, I pay the freedom tax, and I get a phone that is exactly the same, except does not contain a key ring, which keeps me from changing the software on my phone. It's an anti-feature, right? I'm paying to have the anti-feature removed. And I'm happy to pay it, because for me, it's worth it. It's the cost of removing the anti-feature, and I'm willing to pay, because I think about these things in these terms, but most people don't. Many people will recognize this is a photo of OpenMoCo, which was an attempt to build a free phone. Successful attempt. There were many things, for the OpenMoCo users in the room, and I was one of them, there were many things that OpenMoCo didn't do that modern phones do, and there were many things that OpenMoCo did do, but that it didn't do maybe quite so well. Anti-features are what mean that we're carrying around, but anti-features are what mean that we're all carrying around computers with microphones, cameras, sensors, and that we're trusting them with our closest secrets and our most sensitive data, and that in almost all cases, these computers remain controlled completely and totally by companies that very few of us trust at all. If we can communicate about these anti-features in the normal phones, as anti-features, we can begin to build real support for a free software phone alternative where anti-features become impossible. OpenMoCo didn't do a lot of things, but some of the things it didn't do were pretty great. So the second area I want to talk about is network services. This is what you see if you visit the New York Times too many times in a given month. It's a paywall. It's a combination of a subscription-enforced monopoly model and market segmentation. It, of course, doesn't cost the New York Times very much to provide access to articles they've already written to someone who's already viewed 20 articles. And I'm a subscriber to the New York Times. I pay them whatever, $10 a month. But the reason I'm using this is to remind people that in network services, access to the code is no longer a central issue. What matters, of course, is autonomy and control. And in the network service model, the service provider has it. The person running the website has it. And they're the only one. The New York Times paywall serves a real business purpose, and as I've suggested, I pay for it. But it was crafted at immense effort and expense, and this is part of what I'm paying for when I subscribe: the billing system, the monitoring system, the set of roles in the system to enforce it. And when you get into this arms race where you're building stronger systems to prevent people from attacking it, we're paying for that as well. It shows up in the price. This is a free software network service called NewsBlur. I don't know if people have used it, but they're currently a little bit overloaded by the fact that Google Reader decided to shut down and everyone went to their website, because it does a very similar sort of thing as Google Reader. It's a RSS feed reader of some sort. And historically, their model has been to allow you to sign up, but you only get 64 feeds. They've built in the inability to host more feeds than that unless you pay $1 a month or something like that to sign up. It's a sort of anti-feature model. And again, I subscribe to NewsBlur, so I'm not criticizing their model, because unlike the Times and unlike the vast majority of network services, NewsBlur puts their full source code online under a free software licenses. And as a result, the dynamics around the software are very different. So for example, I've been in the argument, I've been in an argument with the creator of NewsBlur over the last few weeks about a feature that I would like. And this was his response to me about 2 days ago. You are well outside the bounds of what I can reasonably accommodate. You are a power user, and as a thank you. And as a power user, I gave you a great way out. Install your own hosted version of NewsBlur. And probably I will. But the freeness of the code keeps Samuel Clay, the author of NewsBlur, honest, because he knows that he has to keep the bulk of the users sort of paying him, to, keeping them happy and keeping him paying him, or else they will leave. And users who leave can immediately and quickly rid themselves of all of the anti-features, because, of course, we have control over the technology. The result, of course, is a better user experience. And the reason I'm using this example is because these are generic problems of hosted hosted network services. Anti-features give us a way to understand the harm that can be done when users are kept helpless and unfree, and a way to reflect on the way in which these systems sort of systematically disadvantage users and what we might do about it. The final thing I want to reflect on as a major sort of challenge for free software is around DRM, because despite victories in the area of music DRM, DRM continues to be a major threat to free software and to user freedom more broadly in video, software, and in embedded systems. DRM, in a serious sense, can be seen as sort of like the mother of all anti-features. No user wants them. Like, nobody has ever demanded the inability to copy music in some way, and yet, according to my colleagues at the EFF, there are probably somewhere around 10,000 people in the world who go to work every day to write DRM systems, which no one has ever wanted, and which will only make people's lives worse. Their users' lives worse. And its anti-featureness has been its downfall, and it's a way to attack it, right? Although it's not always enough. In fact, people who can avoid DRM will sometimes exclaim it on their advertising. This is a flyer for a music website, which I found in a cafe across from my house. And I live in Cambridge, but it's not like a nerd cafe. It's like a normal cafe full of normal people. And this is a company who's advertising their music. And they've written DRM-free, like, as large as they've written their name of their own website, right? The name of their organization, right? The fact that the software doesn't have DRM is something which is seen as a real benefit, right? They're advertising their lack of an anti-feature. And we've seen this very clearly. When Apple started selling DRM-free music, you could pay $150 for the DRM-free version, or you could pay $1 for the DRM version. This is the freedom tax, right? This is the premium on freedom. This is Sony charging you $50 to not install the crapware on your computer. But of course, these anti-features are hard to DRM-style anti-features are hard to sustain in the free world. This is a screenshot taken from Ocular in Debian, the KDE PDF viewer, and there are DRM-like features in PDFs which keep you from printing, for example. There's nothing that keeps you. So of course, if you can display a PDF on your screen, you can print the PDF. But of course, PDFs sometimes ask you to not print them, or they have these sort of soft DRM features in them. And so there was an argument, there was a bug that about whether or not they should respect this, because of course users sometimes want to print things that the creators of the document don't want them to print. And the agreement in the free world is this. So if you open up Adobe Acrobat, if you run it in AcroRead, you can't view anything. If you run it in Ocular, you will get a little dialogue which says, you can't print this because the person who's done this has created this document doesn't want you to. If you'd like to turn that off and print it, you can go and unclick the obey DRM limitations button, right? It's nice to honor the wishes of the creator, but this is the compromise that the free world came from. It's a setting that you can turn on and off, and it's the kind of thing that makes every user of this piece of software happier. So I want to sort of end where I began. In a perfect software development world, even when things work perfectly, what software developers want is simply not always what users want. Anti-features are the most extreme example of this kind of decoupling or this disconnect. And
I hope I've shown a nice way to talk about this broad issue in the context of free software. Free software eliminates anti-features and ensures that we are closer to an alignment between the interest of developers and users. This is an inherent advantage and part of the reason that free software will win. So thanks for listening to me and for putting on such a wonderful conference. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here. Take a few questions if people have some.
Yes. Please stand up. Go to a microphone if you have some minutes left.
Yeah. One comment. You mentioned that free software will help against anti-features, but in practice sometimes this isn't the case. For example, you mentioned Android, and many restrictions are on Android phones, and people it's just too difficult to install an alternative version like CyanogenMod. And then you also have, like, CyanogenMod has also anti-features, which is kind of weird. For example, I'm not updating my version because the new one doesn't have mass storage support anymore. And it's just, in practice, often too complicated to, like, really change the software.
So this question about that sometimes free software can have anti-features, and I think that's correct. You can certainly try, but I think that in a free world, all we're waiting for is someone to come around and remove that anti-feature, which is not an option in the world of proprietary technology. I think it's not that anti-features can't exist in a free world; it's that they can't last in a free world, not in a place where people are willing to. Because I mean, you know, people always make choices to either put up with crap or to expend the effort to fix it. But when people are being exploited and they can fix it, they eventually will.
You mentioned that one of the third point, I think, was that. Anti-features are used to secure monopolies.
Yes.
However, I think your examples with cameras and cell phones, none of these markets are some monopolies, as far as I'm concerned. So why is there no one coming up and saying, okay, I'm producing a cell phone where you can use any battery that you want? Like, why does that not work as a business model?
The question is, so those are monopolies in the sense that they want a monopoly on that if I'm selling batteries for a camera, then there's a monopoly, you know, I want to be the monopoly producer of batteries for this particular camera. So the market, it's sort of the question of where do we draw the market? It's not a monopoly on all cell phones, but it is a monopoly on batteries for this particular cell phone. That's the monopoly they're trying to enforce. Why is there not a better free phone? I believe that there will be in the long run. I think that there are lots of making hardware is very expensive in a way that people that have tried to do this have run into, and it is getting much, much cheaper. And I think that I already use free hardware in places and parts of my life where it was unthinkable even 5 or 10 years ago, and I suspect I'll be using it in increasingly large ones moving forward because fabrication technology is getting cheaper, and you know, this is getting sort of democratized. There was a period of time when writing software was something which happened very rarely outside of where writing software was something that happened required enormous amounts of resources to do. But computers became cheap enough and distributed enough that now large numbers of people in the world, and not even most of them, have access to software development. We'll see it in software first because software is more malleable, but hardware is becoming malleable as well.
So thanks again for coming here and your talk. We are proud to give you an applause.